"The carrion fowl have been busy about the battlefield," said Aylmer. They rode now at an easy pace, and dark came down upon the plains about them. The slow moon mounted, now waxing towards the full, and in its cold silver light the swelling grasslands rose and fell like a wide grey sea. They'd ridden for some 4 hours from the branching of the roads when they drew near to the fords. Long slopes ran swiftly down to where the river spread in stony shoals between high grassy terraces. Borne upon the wind they heard the howling of wolves. Their hearts were heavy, remembering the many men that had fallen in battle in this place. The road dipped between rising turf banks, carving its way through the terraces to the river's edge, and up again upon the further side. There were 3 lines of flat stepping stones across the stream, and between them fords for horses that went from either brink to a bare eyot in the midst. The riders looked down upon the crossings, and it seemed strange to them, for the fords had ever been a place full of the rush and chatter of water upon stones, but now they were silent. The beds of the stream were almost dry, a bare waste of shingles and grey sand.
"This is become a dreary place," said Aylmer. "What sickness has befallen the river? Many fair things Saruman has destroyed. Has he devoured the springs of Isen too?"
"So it would seem," said Gandalf.
"Alas," said Theoden, "must we pass this way, where the carrion beasts devour so many good riders of the mark?"
"This is our way," said Gandalf. "Grievous is the fall of your men, but you shall see that at least the wolves of the mountains do not devour them. It is with their friends, the orcs, that they hold their feast. Such indeed is the friendship of their kind. Come."
They rode down to the river, and as they came the wolves ceased their howling and slunk away. Fear fell on them, seeing Gandalf in the moon, and Shadowfax's horse shining like silver. The riders passed over to the islet, and glittering eyes watched them wanly from the shadows of the bank.
"Look," said Gandalf, "friends have laboured here."
And they saw that in the midst of the eyot a mound was piled, ringed with stones, and set about with many spears.
"Here lie all the men of the mark that fell near this place," said Gandalf.
"Here let them rest," said Aylmer, "and when their spears have rotted and rusted, long still may their mounts stand and guard the fords of Isen."
"Is this your work also, Gandalf, my friend?" said Theoden. "You accomplished much in an evening and a night."
"With the help of Shadowfax and others," said Gandalf. "I rode fast and far. But here beside the mound I'll say this for your comfort. Many fell in the battles of the fords, but fewer than rumour made them. More were scattered than were slain. I gathered together all that I could find. Some men I sent with Grimbold of Westfold to join Erkenbrand. Some I set to make this burial. They have now followed your marshal, Elfhelm. I sent him with many riders to Edoras. Saruman, I knew, had dispatched his full strength against you, and his servants had turned aside from all their errands and gone to Helm's Deep. The land seemed empty of enemies, yet I feared that wolf-riders and plunderers might ride nonetheless to Medoseld while it was undefended. But now I think you need not fear. You'll find your house to welcome your return."
"And glad shall I be to see it again," said Theoden. "Though brief now, I doubt not, shall be my abiding there."
With that the company said farewell to the island and the mound, and passed over the river, and climbed the further bank. Then they rode on, glad to have left the mournful fords. As they went the howling of the wolves broke out anew. There was an ancient highway that ran down from Isengard to the crossings. For some way it took its course beside the river, bending with it east and then north, but at the last it turned away and went straight towards the gates of Isengard, and these were under the mountainside in the west of the valley, 16 miles or more from its mouth. This road they followed, but they did not ride upon it, for the ground beside it was firm and level, covered for many miles about with short springing turf.
They rode now more swiftly, and by midnight the fords were nearly 5 leagues behind. Then they halted, ending their night's journey, for the king was weary. They were come to the feet of the misty mountains, and the long arms of Nan Kurunir stretched down to meet them. Dark lay the vale before them, for the moon had passed into the west, and its light was hidden by the hills. But out of the deep shadow of the dale rose a vast spire of smoke and vapour. As it mounted, it caught the rays of the sinking moon, and spread in shimmering billows, black and silver, over the starry sky.
"What do you think of that, Gandalf?" said Aragorn. "One would say that all the wizard's veil was burning." "There is ever a fume above the valley in these days," said Aelmer. "But I've never seen aught like this before. These are streams rather than smoke.
Saruman is brewing some devilry to greet us. Maybe he's boiling all the waters of Isen, and that's why the river runs dry."
"Maybe he is," said Gandalf. "Tomorrow we shall learn what he's doing. But now let's rest for a while if we can."
They camped beside the bed of the Isen River. It was still silent and empty. Some of them slept a little. But late in the night the watchman cried out, and all awoke. The moon was gone. Stars were shining above, but over the ground there crept a darkness blacker than the night. On both sides of the river it rolled towards them, going northward.
"Stay where you are," said Gandalf. "Draw no weapons. Wait, and it will pass you by."
A mist gathered about them. Above them a few stars still glimmered faintly. But on either side there arose walls of impenetrable gloom. They were in a narrow lane between moving towers of shadow. Voices they heard, whisperings and groanings, and an endless rustling sigh. The earth shook under them. Long it seemed to them that they sat and were afraid, but at last the darkness and the rumour passed, and vanished between the mountain's arms. Away south upon the Hornburg, in the middle night men heard a great noise, as a wind in the valley, and the ground trembled. And all were afraid, and no one ventured to go forth. But in the morning they went out and were amazed, for the slain orcs were gone, and the trees also. Far down into the valley of the deep the grass was crushed and trampled brown, as if giant herdsmen had pastured great droves of cattle there. But a mile below the dike a huge pit had been delved in the earth, and over it stones were piled into a hill. Men believed that the orcs whom they had slain were buried there, but whether those that had fled into the wood were with them, none could say, for no man ever set foot upon that hill. The Death Down it was afterwards called, and no grass would grow there. But the strange trees were never seen in Deeping Coombe again. They had returned at night, and had gone far away to the dark dales of Fangorn. Thus they were revenged upon the orcs. The king and his company slept no more that night, but they saw and heard no other strange thing save one. The voice of the river beside them suddenly awoke. There was a rush of water hurrying down among the stones, and when it had passed, the ice and flowed and bubbled in its bed again, as it had ever done. At dawn they made ready to go on. The light came grey and pale, and they didn't see the rising of the sun. The air above was heavy with fog, and a reek lay on the land about them. They went slowly, riding now upon the highway. It was broad and hard, and well tended. Dimly through the mists they could descry the long arm of the mountains rising on their left. They had passed into Nan Kurunir, the Wizard's Vale. That was a sheltered valley, open only to the south. Once it had been fair and green. And through it the Isen flowed, already deep and strong, before it found the plains. For it was fed by many springs and lesser streams among the rain-washed hills, and all about it there had lain a pleasant, fertile land. It was not so now. Beneath the walls of Isengard there still were acres tilled by the slaves of Saruman, but most of the valley had become a wilderness of weeds and thorns. Brambles trailed upon the ground.
or clambering over bush and bank, made shaggy caves where small beasts housed. No trees grew there, but among the rank grasses could still be seen the burned and axe-hewn stumps of ancient groves. It was a sad country, silent now but for the stony noise of quick waters. Smokes and steams drifted in sullen clouds and lurked in the hollows. The riders did not speak. Many doubted in their hearts, wondering to what dismal end their journey led. After they had ridden for some miles, the highway became a wide street, paved with great flat stones, squared and laid with skill. No blade of grass was seen in any joint. Deep gutters, filled with trickling water, ran down on either side. Suddenly a tall pillar loomed up before them. It was black, and set upon it was a great stone, carved and painted in the likeness of a long white hand. Its finger pointed north. Not far now they knew that the gates of Isengard must stand, and their hearts were heavy, but their eyes could not pierce the mists ahead. Beneath the mountain's arm, within the wizard's veil, through years uncounted, had stood that ancient place that men called Isengard. Partly it was shaped in the making of the mountains, but mighty works the men of Westerness had wrought there of old, and Saruman had dwelt there long and had not been idle. This was its fashion while Saruman was at his height, accounted by many the chief of wizards. A great ring wall of stone, like towering cliffs, stood out from the shelter of the mountainside, from which it ran and then returned again. One entrance only was there made in it, a great arch delved in the southern wall. Here through the black rock a long tunnel had been hewn, closed at either end with mighty doors of iron. They were so wrought and poised upon their huge hinges, posts of steel driven into the living stone, that when unbarred they could be moved with a light thrust of the arms, noiselessly. One who passed in and came at length out of the echoing tunnel beheld a plain, a great circle, somewhat hollowed like a vast shallow bowl, a mile it measured from rim to rim. Once it had been green and filled with avenues, and groves of fruitful trees watered by streams that flowed from the mountains to a lake. But no green thing grew there in the latter days of Saruman. The roads were paved with stone flags, dark and hard, and beside their borders, instead of trees, there marched long lines of pillars, some of marble, some of copper and of iron, joined by heavy chains. Many houses there were, chambers, halls, and passages, cut and tunnelled back into the walls upon their inner side, so that all the open circle was overlooked by countless windows and dark doors. Thousands could dwell there, workers, servants, slaves, and warriors with great store of arms. Wolves were fed and stabled in deep dens beneath. The plain, too, was bored and delved. Shafts were driven deep into the ground. Their upper ends were covered by low mounds and domes of stone, so that in the moonlight the ring of Isengard looked like a graveyard of unquiet dead. For the ground trembled. The shafts ran down by many slopes and spiral stairs to caverns far under. There Saruman had treasuries, storehouses, armories, smithies, and great furnaces. Iron wheels revolved there endlessly, and hammers thudded. At night plumes of vapour steamed from the vents, lit from beneath with red light, or blue, or venomous green. To the centre all the roads ran between their chains. There stood a tower of marvellous shape. It was fashioned by the builders of old, who smoothed the ring of Isengard, and yet it seemed a thing not made by the craft of men, but driven from the bones of the earth and the ancient torment of the hills. A peak and isle of rock it was, black and gleaming hard. Four mighty piers of many-sided stone were welded into one. But near the summit they opened into gaping horns, their pinnacles sharp as the points of spears, keen-edged as knives. Between them was a narrow space, and there upon a floor of polished stone, written with strange signs, a man might stand 500 feet above the plain. This was Orthanc,
the citadel of Saruman, the name of which had, by design or chance, a twofold meaning. For in the Elvish speech, Orthanc signifies Mount Fang, but in the language of the Mark of old, the cunning mind. A strong place and wonderful was Isengard, and long it had been beautiful. And there great lords had dwelt, the wardens of Gondor upon the west, and wise men that watched the stars. But Saruman had slowly shaped it to his shifting purposes, and made it better, as he thought, being deceived, for all those arts and subtle devices, for which he forsook his former wisdom, and which fondly he imagined were his own, came but from Mordor, so that what he made was naught, only a little copy, a child's model or a slave's flattery, of that vast fortress, armoury, prison, furnace of great power, Barad-dûr, the Dark Tower, which suffered no rival, and laughed at flattery, biding its time, secure in its pride and its immeasurable strength. This was the stronghold of Saruman, as fame reported it. For within living memory the men of Rohan had not passed its gates, save perhaps a few, such as Wormtongue, who came in secret and told no man what they saw. Now Gandalf rode to the great pillar of the hand and passed it, and as he did so the riders saw to their wonder that the hand appeared no longer white. It was stained as with dried blood, and looking closer they perceived that its nails were red. Unheeding, Gandalf rode on into the mist, and reluctantly they followed him. All about them now, as if there had been a sudden flood, wide pools of water lay beside the road, filling the hollows, and rills went trickling down among the stones. At last Gandalf halted, and beckoned to them, and they came, and saw that beyond him the mists had cleared, and a pale sunlight shone. The hour of noon had passed. They were come to the doors of Isengard. But the doors lay hurled and twisted on the ground, and all about, stone, cracked and splintered into countless jagged shards, was scattered far and wide, or piled in ruinous heaps. The great arch still stood, but it opened now upon a roofless chasm. The tunnel was laid bare, and through the cliff-like walls on either side great rents and breaches had been torn. Their towers were beaten to dust. If the great sea had risen in wrath and fallen on the hills with storm, it could have worked no greater ruin. The ring beyond was filled with steaming water, a bubbling cauldron, in which there heaved and floated a wreckage of beams and spars, chests and casks and broken gear. Twisted and leaning pillars reared their splintered stems above the flood, but all the roads were drowned. Far off, it seemed, half-veiled in winding cloud, there loomed the island rock. Still dark and tall, unbroken by the storm, the Tower of Orthanc stood. Pale waters lapped about its feet. The king and all his company sat silent on their horses, marvelling, perceiving that the power of Saruman was overthrown, but how they could not guess. And now they turned their eyes towards the archway and the ruined gates. There they saw close beside them a great rubble heap, and suddenly they were aware of two small figures lying on it at their ease, grey-clad, hardly to be seen among the stones. There were bottles and bowls and platters laid beside them, as if they had just eaten well, and now rested from their labour. One seemed asleep. The other, with crossed legs and arms behind his head, leaned back against a broken rock, and sent from his mouth long wisps and little rings of thin blue smoke. For a moment Theoden and Eomer and all his men stared at them in wonder. Amid all the wreck of Isengard, this seemed to them the strangest sight. But before the king could speak, the small smoke-breathing figure became suddenly aware of them, as they sat there silent on the edge of the mist. He sprang to his feet. A young man he looked, or like one, though not much more than half a man in height. His head of brown curling hair was uncovered, but he was clad in a travel-stained cloak of the same hue and shape as the companions of Gandalf had worn when they rode to Edoras. He bowed very low, putting his hand upon his breast. Then, seeming not to observe the wizard and his friends, he turned to Eomer and the king.
"Welcome, my lords, to Isengard," he said. "We are the Door Wardens. Meriadoc, son of Saradoc, is my name, and my companion, who, alas, is overcome with weariness," he gave the other a dig with his foot, "is Peregrine, son of Paladin, of the House of Took. Far in the north is our home. The Lord Saruman is within, but at the moment he is closeted with one Wormtongue, or doubtless he would be here to welcome such honourable guests."
"Doubtless he would," laughed Gandalf. "And was it Saruman that ordered you to guard his damaged doors and watch for the arrival of guests when your attention could be spared from plate and bottle?"
"No, good sir, the matter escaped him," answered Merry gravely. "He has been much occupied. Our orders came from Treebeard, who has taken over the management of Isengard. He commanded me to welcome the Lord of Rohan with fitting words. I've done my best."
"And what about your companions? What about Legolas and me?" cried Gimli, unable to contain himself longer. "You rascals, you woolly-footed and wool-painted truants, a fine hunt you've led us, 200 leagues through fen and forest, battle and death to rescue you, and here we find you feasting and idling and smoking, smoking. Where did you come by the weed, you villains? Hammer and tongs, I'm so torn between rage and joy that if I do not burst, it will be a marvel."
"You speak for me, Gimli," laughed Legolas, "though I would sooner learn how they came by the wine. One thing you've not found in your hunting, and that's brighter wits," said Pippin, opening an eye. "Here you find us sitting on a field of victory amid the plunder of armies, and you wonder how we came by a few well-earned comforts."
"Well-earned," said Gimli, "I can't believe that."
The riders laughed. "It cannot be doubted that we witnessed the meeting of dear friends," said Theoden. "So these are the lost ones of your company, Gandalf. The days are fated to be filled with marvels. Already I've seen many since I left my house, and now here before my eyes stand yet another of the folk of legend. Are not these the halflings that some among us call the Hobbitlung?"
"Hobbits, if you please, lord," said Pippin.
"Hobbits?" said Theoden. "Your tongue is strangely changed, but the name sounds not unfitting so. Hobbits. No report that I've heard does justice to the truth." Merry bowed, and Pippin got up and bowed low. "Your gracious lord, or I hope that I may so take your words," he said, "and here's another marvel. I've wandered in many lands since I left my home, and never till now have I found people that knew any story concerning hobbits." "My people came out of the north long ago," said Theoden. "But I'll not deceive you. We know no tales about hobbits. All that is said among us is that far away, over many hills and rivers, live the halfling folk that dwell in holes in sand dunes. But there are no legends of their deeds, for it's said that they do little, and avoid the sight of men, being able to vanish in a twinkling, and they can change their voices to resemble the piping of birds. But it seems that more could be said."
"It could indeed, lord," said Merry.
"For one thing," said Theoden, "I hadn't heard that they spouted smoke from their mouths."
"That's not surprising," answered Merry, "for it's an art which we have not practised for more than a few generations.
It was Toebold Hornblower, or Longbottom in the South Farthing, who first grew the true pipeweed in his gardens, about the year 1070, according to our reckoning."
"How old Toby came by the plant?"
"You don't know your danger, Theoden," interrupted Gandalf. "These hobbits will sit on the edge of ruin and discuss the pleasures of the table, or the small doings of their fathers, grandfathers and great-grandfathers, and remoter cousins to the 9th degree, if you encourage them with undue patience. Some other time would be more fitting for the history of smoking. Where's Treebeard, Merry?"
"Away on the north side, I believe.
He went to get a drink of clean water. Most of the other Ents are with him, still busy at their work, over there. Merry waved his hand towards the steaming lake, and as they looked, they heard a distant rumbling and rattling, as if an avalanche was falling from the mountainside. Far away came a hum-hum, as of horns blowing triumphantly.
"And is Orthanc then left unguarded?"
asked Gandalf. "There's the water," said Merry, "but Quickbeam and some others are watching it. Not all those posts and pillars in the plain are of Saruman's planting. Quickbeam, I think, is by the rock, near the foot of the stair." "Yes, a tall grey Ent is there," said Legolas, "but his arms are at his sides, and he stands as still as a door-tree."
"It is past noon," said Gandalf, "and we at any rate have not eaten since early morning. Yet I wish to see Treebeard as soon as may be. Did he leave me no message, or has Plate and Bottle driven it from your mind?"
"He left a message," said Merry, "and I was coming to it, but I've been hindered by many other questions. I was to say that, if the Lord of the Mark and Gandalf will ride to the northern wall, they will find Treebeard there, and he'll welcome them. I may add that they'll also find food of the best there. It was discovered and selected by your humble servants." He bowed.
Gandalf laughed. "That's better," he said. "Well, Theoden, will you ride with me to find Treebeard? We must go round about, but it's not far. When you see Treebeard, you will learn much, for Treebeard is Fangorn, and the eldest and chief of the Ents, and when you speak with him, you will hear the speech of the oldest of all living things."
"I will come with you," said Théoden. "Farewell, my hobbits. May we meet again in my house. There you shall sit beside me and tell me all that your hearts desire, the deeds of your grandsires, as far as you can reckon them, and we will speak also of Tobold the Old and his herb lore. Farewell." The hobbits bowed low. "So that is the King of Rohan," said Pippin in an undertone. "A fine old fellow, very polite." Chapter 9. Flotsam and Jetsam. Gandalf and the king's company rode away, turning eastward to make the circuit of the ruined walls of Isengard. But Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas remained behind. Leaving Arod and Harsifel to stray in search of grass, they came and sat beside the hobbits.
"Well, well, the hunt is over, and we meet again at last, where none of us ever thought to come," said Aragorn.
"And now that the great ones have gone to discuss high matters," said Legolas, "the hunters can perhaps learn the answers to their own small riddles. We tracked you as far as the forest, but there are still many things that I should like to know the truth of."
"And there's a great deal, too, that we want to know about you," said Merry. "We've learned a few things through Treebeard, the old Ent, but that's not nearly enough."
"All in good time," said Legolas. "We were the hunters, and you should give an account of yourselves to us first."
"Or second," said Gimli. "It would go better after a meal. I have a sore head, and it's past midday. You truants might make amends by finding us some of the plunder that you spoke of. Food and drink would pay off some of my score against you."
"Then you shall have it," said Pippin. "Will you have it here, or in more comfort in what's left of Saruman's guardhouse, over there under the arch? We had to picnic out here, so as to keep an eye on the road."
"Less than an eye," said Gimli. "But I'll not go into an orc house, nor touch orcs' meat or anything that they've mauled."
"We wouldn't ask you to do that," said Merry. "We've had enough of orcs ourselves to last a lifetime. But there were many other folk in Isengard. Saruman kept enough wisdom not to trust his orcs. He had men to guard his gates. Some of his most faithful servants, I suppose. Anyway, they were favoured and got good provisions."
"And pipeweed?" asked Gimli.
"No, I don't think so," Merry laughed. "But that's another story, which can wait until after lunch."
"Well, let's go and have lunch then," said the dwarf.
The hobbits led the way, and they passed under the arch and came to a wide door upon the left, at the top of a stair. It opened direct into a large chamber, with other smaller doors at the far end, and a hearth and chimney at one side. The chamber was hewn out of the stone, and it must once have been dark, for its windows looked out only into the tunnel, but light came in now through the broken roof. On the hearth wood was burning. "I lit a bit of fire," said Pippin. "It cheered us up in the fogs. There were few faggots about, and most of the wood we could find was wet. But there's a great draught in the chimney. It seems to wind away up through the rock, and fortunately it hasn't been blocked. A fire is handy. I will make you some toast. The bread is 3 or 4 days old, I'm afraid." Aragorn and his companions sat themselves down at one end of a long table, and the hobbits disappeared through one of the inner doors. "Storeroom in there, and above the floods, luckily," said Pippin, as they came back laden with dishes, bowls, cups, knives, and food of various sorts. "And you needn't turn up your nose at the provender, Master Gimli," said Merry. "This is not orc stuff, but man-food, as Treebeard calls it. Will you have wine or beer? There's a barrel inside there, very passable, and this is first-rate salted pork. Or I can cut you some rashers of bacon and broil them, if you like. I'm sorry there's no green stuff. The deliveries have been rather interrupted in the last few days. I can't offer you anything to follow but butter and honey for your bread. Are you content?"
"Indeed, yes," said Gimli. "The score is much reduced."
The three were soon busy with their meal, and the two hobbits, unabashed, set to a second time. "We must keep our guests company," they said. "You are full of courtesy this morning," laughed Legolas. "But maybe, if we hadn't arrived, you'd already have been keeping one another company again." "Maybe, and why not?" said Pippin. "We had foul fare with the orcs, and little enough for days before that. It seems a long while since we could eat to heart's content."
"It doesn't seem to have done you any harm," said Aragorn. "Indeed, you look in the bloom of health." "Aye, you do indeed," said Gimli, looking them up and down over the top of his cup. "Why, your hair is twice as thick and curly as when we parted, and I would swear that you've both grown somewhat, if that's possible for hobbits of your age. This Treebeard, at any rate, has not starved you."
"He hasn't," said Merry. "But Ents only drink, and drink isn't enough for content. Treebeard's draughts may be nourishing, but one feels the need of something solid, and even Lembas is none the worse for a change." "You've drunk of the waters of the Ents, have you?" said Legolas. "Ah, then I think it's likelier that Gimli's eyes don't deceive him. Strange songs have been sung of the draughts of Fangorn." "Many strange tales have been told about that land," said Aragorn. "I've never entered it. Come, tell me more about it, and about the Ents."
"Ents," said Pippin. Ents are all different for one thing, but their eyes are very odd."
He tried a few fumbling words that trailed off into silence. "Oh, well," he went on, "you've seen some at a distance already. They saw you at any rate, and reported that you were on the way, and you'll see many others, I expect, before you leave here. You must form your own ideas."
"Now, now," said Gimli, "we're beginning the story in the middle. I should like a tale in the right order, starting with that strange day when our fellowship was broken."
"You shall have it, if there is time," said Merry. "But first, if you've finished eating, you shall fill your pipes and light up. And then for a little while we can pretend that we're all back safe at Bree again, or in Rivendell."
He produced a small leather bag full of tobacco.
"We have heaps of it," he said, "and you can all pack as much as you wish when we go. We did some salvage work this morning, Pippin and I. There are lots of things floating about. It was Pippin who found 2 small barrels, washed up out of some cellar or storehouse, I suppose. When we opened them, we found they were filled with this, as fine a pipe weed as you could wish for, and quite unspoiled." Gimli took some and rubbed it in his palms and sniffed it.
"It feels good, and it smells good," he said.
"It is good," said Merry. "My dear Gimli, it is long-bottom leaf.
There were the hornblower brand marks on the barrels, as plain as plain. How it came here I can't imagine. For Saruman's private use, I fancy. I never knew that it went so far abroad, but it comes in handy now.
It would, said Gimli, if I had a pipe to go with it. Alas, I lost mine in Moria, more before. Is there no pipe in all your plunder?
No, I'm afraid not, said Merry. We've not found any, not even here in the guard-rooms. Saruman kept this dainty to himself, it seems, and I don't think it would be any use knocking on the doors of Orthonk to beg a pipe of him. We shall have to share pipes, as good friends must at a pinch.
Half a moment, said Pippin. Putting his hand inside the breast of his jacket, he pulled out a little soft wallet on a string. I keep a treasure or two near my skin, as precious as rings to me. Here's one, my old wooden pipe. And here's another, an unused one. I've carried it a long way, though I don't know why. I never really expected to find any pipeweed on the journey, when my own ran out, but now it comes in useful after all. He held up a small pipe with a wide flattened bowl and handed it to Gimli. Does that settle the score between us? He said.
Settle it, cried Gimli. Most noble hobbit, it leaves me deep in your debt.
Well, I'm going back into the open air to see what the wind and sky are doing, said Legolas.
We'll come with you, said Aragorn.
They went out and seated themselves upon the piled stones before the gateway. They could see far down into the valley now. The mists were lifting and floating away upon the breeze.
Now let's take our ease here for a little, said Aragorn. We'll sit on the edge of ruin and talk, as Gandalf says, while he's busy elsewhere. I feel a weariness such as I've seldom felt before. He wrapped his grey cloak about him, hiding his mail shirt, and stretched out his long legs. Then he lay back and sent from his lips a thin stream of smoke.
Look, said Pippin. Strider the Ranger has come back.
He's never been away, said Aragorn. I am Strider and Dúnadan too, and I belong both to Gondor and the North.
They smoked in silence for a while, and the sun shone on them, slanting into the valley from among white clouds high in the west. Legolas lay still, looking up at the sun and sky with steady eyes, and singing softly to himself. At last he sat up.
"Come now," he said. "Time wears on, and the mists are blowing away, or would if you strange folk didn't wreathe yourselves in smoke. What of the tale?"
Well, my tale begins with waking up in the dark and finding myself all strung up in an orc camp, said Pippin.
Let me see. What's today?
The 5th of March in the Shire Reckoning, said Aragorn. Pippin made some calculations on his fingers.
Only 9 days ago, he said.
It seems a year since we were caught.
Well, though half of it was like a bad dream, I reckon that 3 very horrible days followed.
Merry will correct me if I forget anything important. I'm not going into details.
The whips and the filth and stench and all that, it doesn't bear remembering.
With that he plunged into an account of Boromir's last fight and the orc march from Eminweald to the forest. The others nodded as the various points were fitted in with their guesses.
"Here are some treasures that you let fall," said Aragorn. "You'll be glad to have them back."
He loosened his belt from under his cloak and took from it the 2 sheathed knives.
"Well," said Merry, "I never expected to see those again. I marked a few orcs with mine, but Ugluk took them from us. How he glared! At first I thought he was going to stab me, but he threw the things away as if they burned him."
"And here is also your brooch, Pippin," said Aragorn. "I've kept it safe, for it's a very precious thing."
"I know," said Pippin.
"It was a wrench to let it go, but what else could I do?"
"Nothing else," answered Aragorn. "One who can't cast away a treasure at need is in fetters. You did rightly."
"The cutting of the bands on your wrists, that was smart work," said Gimli. "Luck served you there. But you seized your chance with both hands, one might say."
"And set us a pretty riddle," said Legolas. "I wondered if you'd grown wings."
"Unfortunately not," said Pippin. "But you didn't know about Grishnak." He shuddered and said no more, leaving Merry to tell of those last horrible moments. The pawing hands, the hot breath, and the dreadful stench of Grishnak's hairy arms.
"All this about the orcs of Barad-dûr, Lugbors as they call it, makes me uneasy," said Aragorn. "The Dark Lord already knew too much, and his servants also, and Grishnak evidently sent some message across the river after the quarrel. The Red Eye will be looking towards Isengard, but Saruman at any rate is in a cleft stick of his own cutting."
"Yes, whichever side wins, his outlook is poor," said Merry. "Things began to go all wrong for him from the moment his orcs set foot in Rohan."
"We caught a glimpse of the old villain, or so Gandalf hints," said Gimli, "on the edge of the forest."
"When was that?" asked Pippin.
5 nights ago, said Aragorn.
"Let me see," said Merry. 5 nights ago? Now we come to a part of the story you know nothing about. We met Treebeard that morning after the battle, and that night we were at Welling Hall, one of his Enthouses. The next morning we went to Entmoot, a gathering of Ents, that is, and the queerest thing I've ever seen in my life. It lasted all that day and the next, and we spent the nights with an Ent called Quickbeam. And then late in the afternoon, in the third day of their moot, the Ent suddenly blew up. It was amazing. The forest had felt as tense as if a thunderstorm was brewing inside it. Then all at once it exploded. I wish you could have heard their song as they marched. If Saruman had heard it, he would be 100 miles away by now, even if he had had to run on his own legs, said Pippin. Though Isengard be strong and hard as cold as stone and bare as bone, we go, we go, we go to war to hew the stone and break the door. There was very much more. A great deal of the song had no words and was like a music of horns and drums. It was very exciting. But I thought it was only marching music and no more, just a song, until I got here. I know better now. We came down over the last ridge into Nan Cúrinir, after night had fallen, Merry continued. It was then that I first had the feeling that the forest itself was moving behind us. I thought I was dreaming an Entish dream, but Pippin had noticed it too. We were both frightened, but we didn't find out more about it until later.
It was the Huorns, or so the Ents call them in short language. Treebeard won't say much about them, but I think they're Ents that have become almost like trees, at least to look at. They stand here and there in the wood or under its eaves, silent, watching endlessly over the trees, but deep in the darkest dales there are hundreds and hundreds of them, I believe. There's a great power in them, and they seem able to wrap themselves in shadow. It's difficult to see them moving, but they do. They can move very quickly if they're angry. You stand still looking at the weather, maybe, or listening to the rustling of the wind, and then suddenly you find that you're in the middle of a wood with great groping trees all around you. They still have voices and can speak with the Ents. That's why they are called Huorns, Treebeard says, but they have become queer and wild, dangerous. I should be terrified of meeting them if there were no true Ents about to look after them. Well, in the early night we crept down a long ravine into the upper end of the Wizard's Vale, the Ents with all their rustling horns behind them. We couldn't see them, of course, but the whole air was full of creaking. It was very dark, a cloudy night. They moved at a great speed as soon as they'd left the hills and made a noise like a rushing wind. The moon didn't appear through the clouds, and not long after midnight there was a tall wood all round the north side of Isengard. There was no sign of enemies, nor of any challenge. There was a light gleaming from a high window in the tower, that was all. Treebeard and a few more Ents crept on, right round to within sight of the great gates. Pippin and I were with him. We were sitting on Treebeard's shoulders, and I could feel a quivering tenseness in him. But even when they're aroused, Ents can be very cautious and patient. They stood still as carved stones, breathing and listening. Then all at once there was a tremendous stir.
trumpets blared, and the walls of Isengard echoed. We thought that we'd been discovered, and that battle was going to begin. But nothing of the sort. All Saruman's people were marching away.
I don't know much about this war, or about the horsemen of Rohan, but Saruman seems to have meant to finish off the king and all his men with one final blow.
He emptied Isengard. I saw the enemy go, endless lines of marching orcs, and troops of them mounted on great wolves. And there were battalions of men, too. Many of them carried torches, and in the flare I could see their faces. Most of them were ordinary men, rather tall and dark-haired, and grim but not particularly evil-looking. But there were some others that were horrible, man-high, but with goblin faces, sallow, leering, squint-eyed. Do you know, they reminded me at once of that southerner at Bree, only he was not so obviously orc-like as most of these were.
I thought of him too, said Aragorn. We had many of these half-orcs to deal with at Helm's Deep. It seems plain now that that southerner was a spy of Saruman's, but whether he was working with the Black Riders or for Saruman alone, I don't know. It's difficult with these evil folk to know when they're in league and when they are cheating one another.
Well, of all sorts together, there must have been 10,000 at the very least, said Merry. They took an hour to pass out of the gates. Some went off down the highway to the fords, and some turned away and went eastward. A bridge has been built down there, about a mile away, where the river runs in a very deep channel. You could see it now if you stood up. They were all singing with harsh voices and laughing, making a hideous din. I thought things looked very black for Rohan, but Treebeard didn't move. He said,
"My business is with Isengard tonight, with rock and stone."
But though I couldn't see what was happening in the dark, I believe that horns began to move south as soon as the gates were shut again. Their business was with orcs, I think. They were far down the valley in the morning, or at any rate there was a shadow there that one couldn't see through. As soon as Saruman had sent off his army, our turn came. Treebeard put us down and went up to the gates and began hammering on the doors and calling for Saruman. There was no answer except arrows and stones from the walls. But arrows are no use against Ents. They hurt them, of course, and infuriate them, like stinging flies. But an Ent can be stuck as full of orc arrows as a pincushion and take no serious harm. They can't be poisoned, for one thing, and their skin seems to be very thick and tougher than bark. It takes a very heavy axe stroke to wound them seriously. They don't like axes, but there would have to be a great many axemen to one Ent. A man that hacks once at an Ent never gets a chance of a second blow. A punch from an Ent fist crumples up iron like thin tin. When Treebeard had got a few arrows in him, he began to warm up to get positively hasty, as he would say. He let out a great hoom hoom, and a dozen more Ents came striding up. An angry Ent is terrifying. Their fingers and their toes just freeze on to rock, and they tear it up like bread crusts. It was like watching the work of great tree roots in 100 years, all packed into a few moments. They pushed, pulled, tore, shook, and hammered, and clang-bang, crash, crack. In 5 minutes they had these huge gates just lying in ruin, and some were already beginning to eat into the walls like rabbits in a sandpit. I don't know what Saruman thought was happening, but anyway he didn't know how to deal with it. His wizardry may have been falling off lately, of course, but anyway I think he hasn't much grit, not much plain courage alone in a tight place without a lot of slaves and machines and things, if you know what I mean. Very different from old Gandalf. I wonder if his fame was not all along mainly due to his cleverness in settling at Isengard.
No, said Aragorn. Once he was as great as his fame made him. His knowledge was deep, his thought was subtle, and his hands marvellously skilled, and he had a power over the minds of others. The wise he could persuade, and the smaller folk he could daunt.
That power he certainly still keeps. There are not many in Middle-earth that I should say were safe, if they were left alone to talk with him, even now when he has suffered a defeat. Gandalf, Elrond, and Galadriel, perhaps, now that his wickedness has been laid bare, but very few others.
The Ents are safe, said Pippin. He seems at one time to have got round them, but never again. And anyway, he didn't understand them, and he made the great mistake of leaving them out of his calculations. He had no plan for them, and there was no time to make any, once they'd set to work. As soon as our attack began, the few remaining rats in Isengard started bolting through every hole that the Ents made. The Ents let the men go, after they'd questioned them, 2 or 3 dozen only, down at this end. I don't think many orc folk of any size escaped. Not from the Horns. There was a wood full of them all around Isengard by that time, as well as those that had gone down the valley. When the Ents had reduced a large part of the southern walls to rubbish, and what was left of his people had bolted and deserted him, Saruman fled in panic. He seems to have been at the gates when we arrived. I expect he came to watch his splendid army march out. When the Ents broke their way in, he left in a hurry. They didn't spot him at first, but the night had opened out, and there was a great light of stars, quite enough for Ents to see by, and suddenly Quickbeam gave a cry. "The Tree Killer! The Tree Killer!" Quickbeam is a gentle creature, but he hates Saruman all the more fiercely for that. His people suffered cruelly from orc axes. He leapt down the path from the inner gate, and he can move like a wind when he's roused. There was a pale figure hurrying away in and out of the shadows of the pillar, and it had nearly reached the stairs to the tower top. But it was a near thing. Quickbeam was so hot after him that he was within a step or two of being caught and strangled when he slipped in through the door. When Saruman was safe back in Orthonk, it wasn't long before he set some of his precious machinery to work. By that time there were many Ents inside Isengard. Some had followed Quickbeam, and others had burst in from the north and east. They were roaming about and doing a great deal of damage. Suddenly up came fires and foul fumes. The vents and shafts all over the plain began to spout and belch. Several of the Ents got scorched and blistered. One of them, Beachbone, I think he was called, a very tall, handsome Ent, got caught in a spray of some liquid fire and burned like a torch, a horrible sight. That sent them mad. I thought that they'd been really roused before, but I was wrong. I saw what it was like at last. It was staggering. They roared and boomed and trumpeted until stones began to crack and fall at the mere noise of them. Merry and I lay on the ground and stuffed our cloaks into our ears. Round and round the rock of Orthonk, the Ents went striding and storming like a howling gale, breaking pillars, hurling avalanches of boulders down the shafts, tossing up huge slabs of stone into the air like leaves. The tower was in the middle of a spinning whirlwind. I saw iron posts and blocks of masonry go rocketing up hundreds of feet and smash against the windows of Orthonk. But Treebeard kept his head. He hadn't got any burns, luckily. He didn't want his folk to hurt themselves in their fury, and he didn't want Saruman to escape out of some hole in the confusion. Many of the Ents were hurling themselves against the Orthanc rock, but that defeated them. It's very smooth and hard. Some wizardry is in it, perhaps, older and stronger than Saruman's. Anyway, they couldn't get a grip on it, or make a crack in it, and they were bruising and wounding themselves against it. So Treebeard went out into the ring and shouted. His enormous voice rose above all the din. There was a dead silence, suddenly. In it we heard a shrill laugh from a high window in the tower. That had a queer effect on the Ents. They'd been boiling over. Now they became cold, grim as ice, and quiet. They left the plain and gathered round Treebeard, standing quite still. He spoke to them for a little in their own language. I think he was telling them of a plan he had made in his old head long before. Then they just faded silently away in the grey light. Day was dawning by that time. They set a watch on the tower, I believe. But the watchers were so well hidden in shadows and kept so still that I couldn't see them. The others went away north. All that day they were busy, out of sight. Most of the time we were left alone. It was a dreary day, and we wandered about a bit, though we kept out of the view of the windows of Orthonk as much as we could. They stared at us so threateningly. A good deal of the time we spent looking for something to eat. And also we sat and talked, wondering what was happening away south in Rowan, and what had become of all the rest of our company. Every now and then we could hear in the distance the rattle and fall of stone and thudding noises echoing in the hills. In the afternoon we walked round the circle and went to have a look at what was going on. There was a great shadowy wood of Huorns at the head of the valley, and another round the northern wall. We didn't dare to go in, but there was a rending, tearing noise of work going on inside. Ents and Huorns were digging great pits and trenches, and making great pools and dams, gathering all the waters of the Eisen and every other spring and stream that they could find. We left them to it. At dusk, Treebeard came back to the gate. He was humming and booming to himself, and he seemed pleased. He stood and stretched his great arms and legs and breathed deep. I asked him if he was tired.
"Tired?" he said. "Tired? Well, no, not tired, but stiff. I need a good draught of Entwash. We've worked hard. We've done more stone-cracking and earth-gnawing today than we've done in many a long year before. But it's nearly finished. When night falls, don't linger near this gate or in the old tunnel. Water may come through, and it'll be foul water for a while, until all the filth of Saruman is washed away. Then Eisen can run clean again."
He began to pull down a bit more of the walls, in a leisurely sort of way, just to amuse himself. We were just wondering where it would be safe to lie and get some sleep, when the most amazing thing of all happened. There was the sound of a rider coming swiftly up the road. Mary and I lay quiet, and Treebeard hid himself in the shadows under the arch. Suddenly a great horse came striding up like a flash of silver. It was already dark, but I could see the rider's face clearly. It seemed to shine, and all his clothes were white. I just sat up staring with my mouth open. I tried to call out and couldn't. There was no need. He halted just by us and looked down at us. "Gandalf," I said at last, but my voice was only a whisper.
Did he say, "Hello, Pippin, this is a pleasant surprise."
"No, indeed," he said.
"Get up, you tomfool of a Took. Where in the name of wonder, in all this ruin, is Treebeard? I want him, quick."
Treebeard heard his voice and came out of the shadows at once. And there was a strange meeting. I was surprised, because neither of them seemed surprised at all. Gandalf obviously expected to find Treebeard here, and Treebeard might almost have been loitering about near the gates on purpose to meet him. Yet we'd told the old Ent all about Moria. But then I remembered a queer look he gave us at the time. I can only suppose that he'd seen Gandalf or had some news of him, but wouldn't say anything in a hurry.
"Don't be hasty," is his motto, but nobody, not even elves, will say much about Gandalf's movements when he's not there.
"Home, Gandalf," said Treebeard. "I'm glad you've come. Wood and water, stock and stone, I can master, but there is a wizard to manage here."
"Treebeard," said Gandalf, "I need your help. You've done much, but I need more. I have about 10,000 orcs to manage."
Then those two went off and had a council together in some corner. It must have seemed very hasty to Treebeard, for Gandalf was in a tremendous hurry, and was already talking at a great pace before they passed out of hearing. They were only away a matter of minutes, perhaps a quarter of an hour. Then Gandalf came back to us, and he seemed relieved, almost merry. He did say he was glad to see us then. "But Gandalf," I cried, "where have you been? And have you seen the others?"
"Wherever I have been, I am back," he answered in the genuine Gandalf manner. "Yes, I've seen some of the riders, but news must wait. This is a perilous night, and I must ride fast."